Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 31st of August, 2017. I want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, email, web addresses, heap pages, anything you can use to take action for the environment. Let's start off with announcements. The African Wildlife Foundation has learned with great sadness about the death of renowned conservationist Wayne Lotter in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. A dedicated wildlife conservationist, Wayne was the director and co-founder of the PAMS Foundation and died doing what he loved most, protecting the African elephant. He devoted his life to Africa's wildlife, including while working as a ranger in his native South Africa and later leading the charge against poaching in Tanzania. African Wildlife Foundation President Kudu Sumbunya said, "Africa has lost a visionary leader and mentor. Africa has lost a great friend and a champion for wildlife." AWF worked with Wayne in Ruvuma and Selous in Tanzania, and we are saddened by his brutal murder on Wednesday, August 16th, 2017. Our deepest condolences to his family and the PAMS team. Such a tragic loss for the African elephant, said Mr. Sabunya. Mr. Sabunya added that Wayne supported African rangers and dedicated himself to enabling them to grow and excel in their work. In a message to the PAMS team, AWF Chief Operating Officer Jeff Christfield offered AWF support to ensure that Wayne's work can continue after this tragic event. Wayne was one of the true heroes of conservation in Africa, and in the PAMS Foundation, he created something larger than himself. As a conservation community, we must stand together to ensure that his wife's work continues, said Mr. Christfield. Wayne was a brave crusader who supported efforts to curb wildlife trafficking. He is credited with developing an intelligence-based approach that helped stop runaway poaching in Tanzania. The threats to African elephants are real, and the war is far from being won. I believe Wayne would want all conservationists to join with other social forces to make every effort in winning this fight against poaching, said Mr. Sabunya. The African Wildlife Foundation extends its deepest sympathies to Wayne's family, co-founder Chrissy Clark, and the PAMS Foundation team. And you can get more information about the African Wildlife Foundation at awf.org. And the whale wars will continue in this commentary by Captain Paul Watson. Sea Shepherd has accomplished something absolutely remarkable over the last 12 years. In 2005, we set out to tackle the world's largest and most destructive whaling fleet. We were told it was impossible by some governments and a few other NGOs. Hardly anyone knew about Japan's illegal slaughter in the Southern Ocean. It was way out of sight and out of mind. They were targeting 1,035 whales a year, including a yearly quota of 50 endangered humpbacks and 50 endangered fin whales. We had few resources, but we took our one battered and slow vessel, the Farley Mowat, and we chased the whalers across the Southern Ocean, catching them only for a few hours at a time until they sped away from us. In 2006, we were able to purchase the Steve Irwin, and the tables began to turn as each year we became stronger and more effective. We brought in the Bob Barker, the Sam Simon, and the Brigitte Bardot, and the Ocean Warrior. Sea Shepherd was relentless in reducing the yearly quotas significantly, and in the 2012-2013, the Japanese whalers went home with only about 10% of their intended kill. We did this at the same time the U.S. federal court put significant legal obstacles in our path. The results speak for themselves. Over 6,000 whales saved, not a single endangered humpback killed, and only 10 endangered fin whales killed in a decade, where 500 were slated to die. In addition, the Japanese whalers lost tens of millions of dollars. We exposed Japan's illegal activities to the world in our TV show Whale Wars and in our documentation. We helped to push Australia into taking Japan to the International Court of Justice, where their operations were ruled to be unlawful. Japan was ordered by the AJC to cease and desist. They did so for a year and then returned with a new program, also illegal, that reduced their bogus self-kill quota to 333 each year. This means that since 2015, another 1,400 whales were spared the lethal harpoons. This means that 702 whales will continue to be saved every year. Unfortunately, in an effort to prevent Sea Shepherd interventions, they doubled their killing grounds, which means that they have more time and more area to kill their lowered quota. Despite that, Sea Shepherd sent the Steve Irwin and Ocean Warrior in pursuit of the whalers in 2016-17, and although it took them longer and cost them much more, the Japanese whalers managed to get their quota. What we discovered is that Japan is now employing military surveillance to watch Sea Shepherd ship movements in real time by satellite, and if they know where our ships are at any given moment, they can easily avoid us. During Operation Nemesis, the Sea Shepherd ships did get close, and our helicopter even managed to get evidence of their illegal whaling operations, but we could not physically close the gap. We cannot compete with our military-grade technology. This year, Japan escalated their resistance by the passing of new anti-terrorism laws, some of which are specifically designed to condemn Sea Shepherd tactics. For the first time ever, they have stated that they will send their military to defend their illegal whaling activities. The Japanese whalers not only have all the resources and subsidies their government can provide, they also have the political backing of major superpower. Sea Shepherd, however, is limited in resources, and we have hostile governments against us in Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. The decision we had had to face is, do we spend our limited resources on another campaign to the Southern Ocean that we have little chance of successful interventions, or do we regroup with different strategies and tactics? If something is not working, the only recourse is to look for a better plan, because when a plan no longer works, the only alternative is an improved course of action. We need to reformulate this plan, and we will. We will not be sending ships to the Southern Ocean this year, but are not abandoning the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. We need to cultivate the resources, the tactics, and the ability to significantly shut down the illegal whaling operations of the Japanese whaling fleet. In the meantime, it's for the Australian government to live up to their promises. Sea Shepherd has been down in the Southern Ocean doing what the Australian government has the responsibility to do but have refused to do, and that is upholding international and Australian conservation law. Instead of supporting Sea Shepherd, the Australian government has been supporting the Japanese whalers by harassing Sea Shepherd and obstructing Sea Shepherd's ability to raise funds by denying our charitable status. What Sea Shepherd has accomplished over the 12 years demonstrates what people of passion can accomplish with few resources despite heavy multi-government opposition. The Japanese whalers have been exposed, humiliated, and most importantly have been denied thousands of lives that we have spared from their deadly harpoons. Thousands of whales are now swimming and reproducing that would be dead if not for our interventions. And perhaps more significantly than anything else, there are new voices in the Japanese government opposing the continuation of whaling. Our efforts have been like acupuncture needles stuck into Japanese society, probing and provoking responses. We have exposed the incredible waste of money, the corruption, and the shame this dirty business has brought to all Japanese people. Our efforts have been so significant that one Japanese official said that Japan has two enemies, China and Sea Shepherd. Sea Shepherd's continuing efforts to go after and shut down whalers will continue, and not only against Japanese whaling, but also against Norwegian, Danish, and Icelandic whaling. This is what we have been doing for 40 years. We will never quit until the abomination of whaling is abolished forever by anyone, anywhere, and for any reason. Sea Shepherd is doing incredible things on the ocean with limited resources. In addition to tackling illegal whaling activities, the endangered vaquita would now be extinct if not for our intervention. We shut down the entire Southern Ocean pirate toothfish fleet. We have intercepted and stopped poachers off of West Africa in the marine reserves of the Galapagos, Sicily, and Panama. We have removed hundreds of tons of ghost nets and plastics from the sea. And most importantly, we have shown the world what a few passionate and courageous people can do.
Our object is to continue to serve and protect all life in the ocean from illegal and greedy exploitation by destructive humans. Sea Shepherd is guided by this one reality. If the ocean dies, we die. And that's the statement from Sea Shepherd founder Captain Paul Watson. And an action alert telling folks about the ill-advised Cadiz water plan. Why would you remove water from the desert? Cadiz Incorporated wants to pump 16 billion, that's with a B, gallons of water each year from the Mojave Desert for export and sale. Cal Wild knows that our desert ecosystems are fragile and threatened as it is, and that this project would do irreparable harm to the desert's wildlife and human communities. What makes this project even more reprehensible is the cozy relationship Cadiz Incorporated has forged with President Trump and certain anti-public land members of Congress, including Paul Cook. Together, these politicians have overturned Obama administration policies allowing Cadiz to evade federal environmental review for the project and aim to reduce the Mojave Trail's national monument in size so their contract can proceed. Luckily, Assemblymember Laura Friedman has introduced AB 1000, the California Desert Protection Act, to prevent this disastrous project from happening, but this bill needs to pass the Senate and Assembly by the end of the session on September 15th. So please write your state legislators now here in California and tell them to support AB 1000. And remember, personal notes about the importance of the Mojave Desert to you and your family make your comments even stronger. And for more information, go to www.calwild.org. That's CALWILD.ORG. And the Idaho Fish and Game Commission has unanimously rejected wolf baiting, at least for now, in this story by Betsy Russell of the Spokesman Review. In a unanimous vote, the Idaho Fish and Game Commission has rejected the idea of allowing hunters to bait wolves, at least for now. A large majority of the public comments to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game received on the proposal opposed baiting. Commissioner Jerry Myers said he would like more information about wolf baiting before moving ahead with any plan, the AP reported. I would like to have time to think about the rule, he told fellow commissioners, to decide which areas and to what extent. Commissioners noted they would revisit the idea in the future. Andrea Santarcier, a senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, who is based in Victor, Idaho, applauded the decision. In our view, baiting is unethical and unsportsmanlike, and we're glad to hear that the commission listened to the public's opinion on this issue, she said. Idaho already has lots of tools in the toolbox to kill wolves, so we don't think it was necessary to add baiting to that list. We're just really glad the proposal was shot down by the commission and we'll be watching in case it surfaces again. No other state allows the use of bait in hunting for wolves. Idaho currently allows bait to be used only in the hunting of black bears, and that practice is a controversial one. A 1996 voter initiative that sought to ban it prompted a high-profile emotional debate before failing at the polls 40-60%. Right now, under Idaho rules, someone who is hunting black bears with bait and also has a wolf tag could legally harvest a wolf that responds to the bait if the hunter has the necessary permits. The new wolf baiting rule that the commission rejected would have allowed hunters to target wolves with bait outside of bear season. And from Bite Back magazine, as found on directaction.info, we read that a mink insurrection has taken place in Småland, and I believe that is in Sweden. On the night between Saturday and Sunday, 26th and 7th of August, thousands of minks got assistance in their escape from a prison known as a mink farm. 100-something of them moved by getting transported directly to the forest, where for the first time they could feel solid ground beneath their paws. The rest got a helping hand as the cages were opened and they could charge off into the night. Unfortunately, we didn't succeed in opening every last case, as we had to leave quite suddenly, but we will continue to work for the opening of all cages and the closing of all farms. We will never give up. The owner of the fur farm locks up exploits and kills these minks only to make money. The whole fur industry is driven by capitalist interests, and we must all act in solidarity with the minks. Working against exploitation, capitalism, and incarceration is best done through united struggle. The mink insurrection takes place during the week of solidarity with anarchist prisoners, and we send greetings over all the fences, walls, and borders until they are all free. Signed, the Animal Liberation Front. And 29 Chilean timber trucks have been torched. The Huichen Aucu Mapu claim responsibility in this story from Reuters, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Writing from Chile, a group of armed men claiming to represent the nation's indigenous Mapuche people hijacked and burned 29 logging trucks in southern Chile on Monday morning as a years-long conflict with the forestry companies heated up. The government convened an emergency meeting less than 2 weeks after a similar hijacking in which 18 trucks were burned, and several high-ranking officials denounced the attack later in the day. It was not clear to what extent the attacks have broader support among the Mapuche communities. Many Mapuche leaders doubt that all such attacks are carried out by indigenous people, saying non-indigenous groups with radical political agendas may be involved. The group Huichen Aucu Mapu, or Fight of the Rebel Territory in the local Mapudungun language, claimed responsibility, national media reported. According to local authorities, at least two people were responsible for the arson attack, although local media reported that as many as seven were responsible. Around 600,000 Mapuche live in Chile, concentrated in Araucania and Biobío, two lush and hilly provinces approximately 400 miles south of Santiago, the nation's capital. Ever since the Chilean army invaded Mapuche country with a brutal campaign in the late 1800s, relations with the state have been fractious. The conflict has accelerated in recent years with armed groups burning houses, churches, trucks, and forest plantations. It has also spread geographically. The Monday attack occurred in the region of Los Rios, south of the traditional conflict zone. The trucks belong to Sotracer, a subcontractor that serves subsidiaries of Chilean forest companies Empresas and Arauco. The company reported $6 million in damages. While that figure is not significant in relationship to Chile's larger timber industry, subcontractors have begun to register dozens of attacks annually in recent years, weighing on the sector. And the reporting was by Graham Slattery, editing by Jeffrey Bencoe and Sandra Mahler of the Reuters News Agency. Brazilian judge has stymied a plan to allow mining in the Amazon region in this story by Ernesto Londono and Shannon Sims of the New York Times, as found in the Earth First Newswire. A federal judge in Brazil has temporarily halted a plan by President Michel Temer to allow mining in a large area of the Amazon forest, dealing a victory to environmental activists who had denounced the initiative as potentially calamitous. In a ruling issued Tuesday, Judge Rolando Valcir Spanholo said the executive branch had exceeded its authority in rescinding the designation of a 17,700-square-mile region known by the Portuguese acronym RENCA as a protected area through a presidential decree. The judge said that only Congress could make that change. The ruling came after the government thought to respond to an international outcry by issuing an updated version of the RENCA decree that more broadly outlines steps to mitigate environmental damage, safeguard the rights of indigenous communities, and retain protected areas. But opponents say the plan will hasten development that has encroached on the rainforest and accelerate deforestation and the displacement of native peoples. The injunction was granted in response to a lawsuit by Antonio Carlos Fernandez, a lawyer and university professor in the northeastern city of Fortaleza, who said he felt compelled to act after reading about the growing opposition to the decree in Brazil and abroad. "I'm a regular citizen," he said in an interview. "Now, I am certain that a regular citizen can have a lot of strength." The government has argued that authorizing regulated mining in the region will curb illegal gold mining and generate new jobs. The area also contains deposits of iron and copper. The government said it will appeal the decision. While the appeal process plays out, regional prosecutors and members of Congress who oppose the opening of the area to mining are gearing up for a protracted legal and legislative struggle. The suspension of President Temer's unilateral decree with its severe threats to vast Amazonian forest offers a welcome and temporary reprieve, said Christian Poirier, program director for Amazon Watch. Today's ruling upholds the constitutional guarantees and puts the brake on this drastic regression, but it is ultimately vulnerable to being overruled by higher courts. And environmental groups are suing the Hawaiian Department of Transportation over Bright Harbor and airport lights. In this story from the Maui Times, as written by Anthony Pignataro, sometimes I'm amazed that any animals manage to survive in this monstrous machine called civilization that we humans have built for ourselves. Even constructions that seem completely innocent can wreak havoc on the other less evolved species. I thought of all of this last week when I got a news release from the environmental law firm Earth Justice announcing a new lawsuit from a coalition of Hawaii organizers against the State Department of Transportation. The reason for the suit? The department's failure to address injuries and deaths of three species of critically imperiled seabirds caused by bright lighting at state-operated airports and harbors on Kauai, Maui, and Lanai, according to the lawsuit. The groups represented by Earth Justice, Hoi Homamalu Akaiaina Conservation Council for Hawaii and the Center for Biological Diversity, assert in their suit that the threatened species Newell shearwater and the endangered species Hawaiian petrels and band-rumped storm petrels are all at risk from the bright lights of Hawaii's harbors and airports. The seabirds are attracted to bright lights like those at the department's airport and harbor facilities, stated the news release. Indeed, those facilities are among the largest documented sources in the state of injury and death to the birds. The seabirds become disoriented and circle the lights until they fall to the ground from exhaustion or crash into nearby buildings. According to Earth Justice, last October, the State Department of Transportation abruptly broke off discussions with federal and state wildlife agencies regarding its participation in an island-wide habitat conservation plan to minimize and mitigate harm to the rare seabirds on Kauai. Now the groups want the DOT to comply with its obligations under the Endangered Species Act to minimize and mitigate harm to imperiled seabirds by securing incremental take permit coverage of its activities on all three islands, according to the press release. Put simply, the Endangered Species Act of 1973 prohibits activities that take, which include harassing, injuring, or killing endangered species. Given that some activities will inevitably harm species, organizations like the DOT can first obtain an incidental take permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but such permits place various restrictions on the activity. The groups filing the suit allege that the Hawaii Department of Transportation never did this. The tragic deaths of the endangered seabirds were preventable, said Brian Siege, an attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, in their August 23rd news release. Department of Transportation can't keep ignoring the Endangered Species Act. The department needs to do right by these amazing birds and improve conditions on the ground to offset the real harm caused over the years by these very bright lights. And the fight for wild salmon escalates in British Columbia after Washington's farmed salmon spill, in this story from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. A second salmon farm is now occupied by First Nations. The Muskamagwu Zawada-i-Nuxwa, led by Hereditary Chief Willie Moon, occupied another marine harvest salmon farm, Wicklow Point, in the Broughton Archipelago off northeastern Vancouver Island on Thursday. The second occupation follows their August 23rd day-long peaceful occupation of Cermak's Birdwood Farm. On August 24th, Ceremonial Chief Ernest Alfred led a group of Namgis and Mama Lala Kala First Nations as they occupied the Marine Harvest owned Swanson Salmon Farm. Today is the eighth day of that occupation. These First Nations state they will remain on the farms until our chiefs are satisfied that the province of British Columbia has canceled the licenses of occupation for the salmon farms in their territory. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society's research vessel, the RV Martin Sheen, is on scene in the archipelago providing support for the indigenous people occupying the farms. The Sheen is currently in the British Columbian waters for its wild salmon defense campaign, Operation Virus Hunter 2, assisting independent biologist Alexandra Morton in protecting the British Columbian coast from the salmon farms for the second year in a row. News of the second occupation comes less than 2 weeks after a malfunctioning salmon farm net at Cook Agriculture Farm in Washington State released over 300,000 10-pound Atlantic salmon into the Pacific Ocean, raising concerns over the non-native fish causing harm to local wild salmon populations. And that story was reported last week on the Earth First Update. Many of these escaped salmon have now made their way north, are being caught by the First Nations of Canada, so that they do not become an invasive species or introduce diseases that will contribute to the decline of the already dwindling salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest. After the live salmon spill by Cook Aquaculture, the governor of Washington State took action and halted the expansion of this industry in Washington State. Canadian First Nations that claim that the salmon farming industry is trespassing on unceded territory are calling for the British Columbian government to remove the industry from their waters. Why isn't Prime Minister Justin Trudeau taking the impact that salmon farms have on our First Nation people seriously? As Sea Shepherd's Carolina Castro, Operation Virus Hunter 2's campaign leader. Castro also pointed out that during his speech addressing the Assembly of First Nations in Quebec in 2015, Trudeau said that the constitutionality guaranteed rights of First Nations in Canada are not an inconvenience, but a sacred obligation. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon, that is Friday at 3 p.m. You could also tune in to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon, KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Go to their schedule for day and time of rebroadcast. You could also tune in the Grateful Dread Public Radio at gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. Or you can always listen to radioforall.net, where you can go online and listen or download this or previous Earth First Updates. That's radio4all.net. And I'm asking you to please check with your local nonprofit community radio station and ask them to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in for next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.